and two men briefly met. Commander Douglas Scott and Captain Philip Kern. He pictured their faces, remembered how it felt to stand in their presence, and opened his mind. Simon could still see Steve. He was still aware of his surroundings, but his mind was focused on a different location. On two different locations, to be precise. Dark, confined, and filled with strange noises, like those one might hear in the womb. He could hear voices around him, voices speaking in clear, efficient tones. He heard the answers made, the orders given. He was there and present. Simon allowed his mind to explore these alien environs, just enough to reassure himself that the details he had worked so hard to procure were accurate and accessible. They were. Complex systems, exactly as the blueprints had depicted, but in the end they were just switches and valves, electrical switches, mechanical valves, sensitive dials circled in red. It was time to act. No one would be killed, no one would be hurt. There would be confusion, there would be fear, but no one would be hurt. It was time to act. Simon flicked the switches, opened the valves, and saw the dials swing into the red. There was confusion, there was fear, and Simon withdrew. "I said, they're not coming," repeated Steve, bending forwards and raising his voice as if Simon were hard of hearing. "The UK government is not interested in some spoonbender from Altrincham. You'd be better off speaking to the producers of daytime telly. Least that way you could make some decent money." Simon looked up at Steve, and the expression in his eyes made the former SAS man feel sick. "What is it?" he asked. "What have you done?"
"What I had to," said Simon.
Steve stepped back from Simon as if he did not recognize him. For the first time since meeting him, he felt like leaving. He felt like running. Then, out of the corner of his eye, he saw them coming. Three dark, unmarked cars, driving with unmistakable purpose. Steve felt cornered, trapped. As the cars surrounded the restaurant's forecourt, Steve cast an accusing glance at Simon, who looked back at him with an expression of guilt, sympathy, and unflinching determination. Several men stepped out of the cars. They had a hard, no-nonsense look about them. "Special branch," thought Steve. "Christ, what kind of shit have I got myself into?" One of the henchmen approached Simon and Steve. "This way, gentlemen," he said in a tone that might have seemed polite had it not been so menacing. Simon got up from the wall and walked towards the middle car. With a heavy sigh, Steve started to follow him, but the henchman blocked his path. "The other car, Mr. Brennus, if you please," he said, nodding towards the car at the rear of the convoy. Steve groaned out another sigh. He recognized the procedure: divide and conquer, separate the subjects, question them in isolation, play them off against each other, do not allow them the opportunity to corroborate their stories. Rueing the fact of ever having met Simon, Steve made his way to the rear car. Another henchman held the door open for him, and Steve glanced up towards the middle car where Simon was being similarly apprehended. Steve saw Simon nod his thanks to the henchman, but before he disappeared inside the car, he cast a look back at Steve. Steve gave a soft snort of surprise and found his despairing mood somewhat lifted. There was a fire burning in Simon's stone-gray eyes, and something close to a smile on his face, and Steve found himself feeling suddenly sorry for the people taking them into custody, the people who would soon be interrogating Simon. "They haven't a clue of what they're up against," he thought. "Not a fucking clue." Chapter 21. Richard Chatham had only been to Manchester twice before, both times as a visiting student from King's College, Cambridge. The city had changed a good deal since then. It was busier, for a start,
It had taken them almost as long to get from the airport to the city centre as it had been for them to fly from London. Chatham was still reeling from the speed with which the morning's events had unfolded. After speaking to Simon, he had put down one phone only to pick up another immediately afterwards. "I think you have another call coming through," Simon had said. Chatham knew it would not be good news even before he recognised the voice of the Chancellor of the Exchequer. "Chatham?" the Chancellor had demanded. "Richard Chatham?" "Yes, sir," Chatham had replied. "What can I do for you? Do you know someone by the name of Simon?" Chatham had closed his eyes, let out a long, heavy sigh, and his feet had barely touched the ground since. Now he looked out of the tinted window as the car drove past the neoclassical facade of Bootle Street Police Station, a large three-story red brick building in the heart of Manchester. The car turned onto Bootle Street, where a high archway allowed cars through to the internal courtyard at the centre of the building. Chatham felt an oppressive sense of finality as the car passed under the imposing arch, and he wondered just how many criminals had been driven in the same way, seeing their liberty come to an end as the building closed around them. Beside him, in the back of the car, the Chancellor of the Exchequer was speaking quietly into his mobile phone. Indeed, he had hardly been off it since he had picked Chatham up from his office earlier that morning. The Prime Minister, who was on a state visit to the US, the Governor of the Bank of England, the Attorney General, to get provisional authorization for Mr. Brennus's immunity. Then it was the Foreign Secretary and the Chief of the Defence Staff, Admiral Joseph Grant, who was currently hosting his American counterpart, Vice Admiral Edwin T. Fallon.
"We've just arrived," said the Chancellor, speaking once more to the Foreign Secretary. "Yes, they're already in custody," he added, after a pause.
Chatham glanced across discreetly, trying to keep the regret and contempt from his face. It seemed that, in the space of just a few hours, Simon had gone from intriguing goldmine of useful information to public enemy number one and threat to the world's economy.
"That's right," the Chancellor went on. "It's not just the markets. There are defence implications too. The PM wants the military involved."
The Chancellor paused, listening.
"No," he said. "It's just the Americans for now. Fallon will be speaking for the White House. Admiral Grant is bringing him down from Glasgow. It seems the FBI had already flagged this guy as a possible risk to national security."
A frown of disapproval creased Chatham's brow. They knew next to nothing about Simon, and yet they were already prepared to cast him in the worst possible light. The car came to a halt, and Chatham took hold of his briefcase as a police officer came to escort them into the building, where they were met by Chief Constable David McCormack, the commanding officer of Greater Manchester Police.
"Chancellor," the Chief Constable said, by way of a greeting, "Mr. Chatham."
"Where is he?"
asked the Chancellor, as the Chief Constable led them through to an empty office. Chatham noticed the eyes of the people watching them as they passed. It was clearly no secret that something unusual was going on.
"We've got him in one of our secure interview rooms," said the Chief Constable, closing the door. "And his accomplice?"
"Likewise," said the Chief Constable.
"Accomplice? Oh, please," thought Chatham with distaste.
Both Chatham and the Chancellor refused the offer of tea or coffee, and neither felt inclined to take a seat when it was offered.
"Forgive me, Chancellor," the Chief Constable began, "but what exactly are we looking at here? My briefing was somewhat lacking in detail. Just what is this guy supposed to have done?"
The Chancellor seemed momentarily at a loss.
"Mr. Chatham," he said.
Chatham was put on the spot. He felt himself flush with indignation.
"Well," he began, "he breached MI5 security and compromised a diplomatic clean line. He is in possession of passwords to highly sensitive information," he added, struggling to think of anything specific that Simon had done wrong. Breaching security and obtaining passwords were not crimes in themselves. True, a crime might have been committed in achieving these things, but as yet,
They had no evidence of such. The Chancellor seemed unsatisfied with Chatham's summary of Simon's misdemeanors. With the help of his accomplice, Mr. Brennus, he cut in. He evaded federal authorities in America, who wanted to detain him for questioning.
And, the Chancellor added with a stern glance in Mr. Chatham's direction, he is suspected of manipulating stock market figures, which could have unimaginable consequences for the international trading community.
So, what is he? Asked the Chief Constable. A hacker? Some kind of computer whiz kid?
We don't know, said Chatham.
It's not computers, said the Chancellor reflectively. No system for predicting figures could be that accurate. It's impossible. The Chancellor sounded like a man whose faith, whose entire world view had been undermined. Chatham knew exactly how he felt. There was a sudden knock on the door.
Yes,
shouted the Chief Constable. A young officer poked his head around the door.
"'Scuse me, sir,' he said. "'There's some men in navy uniform to see you.'
"'Well, don't just stand there,' snapped the Chief Constable. "'Show them in.'
The secure interview room was grey and windowless. One of the special branch henchmen stood near the door, unmoving, unsmiling. The plastic cup of coffee on the table in front of Steve was cold and untouched. He watched the greyish-brown surface ripple with minute concentric rings as heavy traffic rumbled past the building, the only evidence that the world outside existed. Steve tried to marshal his thoughts. He had no idea what Simon had done, no idea why Special Branch would be interested in him at all. But whatever it was, Steve was now caught up in it. He had trusted Simon from the beginning, even when he had no reason to do so. It was a gut feeling, and Steve trusted his instincts, but now, after what must be an hour of sitting in this room, he was beginning to have his doubts. Simon had not told him everything, that was clear, and now Steve was paying the price for his trust. He was not worried about the questioning. His SAS training had prepared him for far worse than this. Besides, he had done nothing wrong. Okay, he had beaten up a couple of American lowlifes and failed to return a rental car to the depot. But one was self-defense, and the other was hardly the crime of the century. No. The thoughts that bedeviled his mind were closer to home. All Steve could think about was his wife and his little girl. Being apart from them, even for a few short days, had been a torment in itself. Not to mention the guilt and regret he felt over what had happened. The practical, financial problems that had befallen them were of nothing compared to that. All right, so they were bankrupt and homeless. But they would get through this, rebuild their lives. Two more days, thought Steve bitterly. Two more days and this job was over. Steve could forget about Simon and all this psychic nonsense. Two more days and he could go back to his family, phone call from Christine or not. A few days in the sin bin was the least he deserved, but what he had done had not been deliberate. It was a foolish outburst, understandable in the heat of the moment. Surely Christine would be able to see that. And surely Sally would be able to forgive him, to trust him again, in time, surely. Steve's eyes pricked with tears. He raised a hand to brush them away. He wished they would come for him and get this started. He wished the questions would begin. He wished he had never met Simon. Chatham felt strangely nervous. Not about being in the company of such powerful men. He dealt with people of power on a daily basis. No, Chatham felt nervous for an altogether different reason. He was about to meet Simon. A wave of furtive looks followed the procession of dour-looking men as they made their way through the police station. First came the Chief Constable of Greater Manchester Police, followed by the Chancellor of the Exchequer, two admirals in full navy uniform, each with a uniformed aide in tow, and finally Mr. Richard Chatham of MI5, International Liaison for National Security. In their wake, they left a murmur of excited whispers as people speculated on who the Materia's detainees might be. The group descended the steps to the secure interview rooms. They passed one door with an officer standing outside and moved on to the door at the far end of the corridor. At a nod from the chief constable, the officer standing guard produced a key and unlocked the door. The procession moved inside. The door was closed and locked from the outside. Simon looked up as they entered the room. In the center of the room was a large table. Simon was seated on the far side, while on the near side there were chairs for the five prominent men. The two naval aides went to stand discreetly against the wall behind their respective admirals. Four of the men moved to take their seats, but Chatham remained standing as Simon rose suddenly from his chair and walked round the table to meet him. The special branch henchman moved to intercept Simon, but he was too far away and had not been expecting the suspect to move. "Mr. Chatham," said Simon, smiling warmly. "It's a pleasure to meet you." "And you, Simon," said Chatham, smiling in turn despite the disapproving glares from the other men at the table. The two men shook hands until the henchman directed Simon back to his chair. Simon returned to his seat, and Chatham too sat down. He could not take his eyes off Simon. He was younger than he'd been expecting, but apart from that he looked just as he sounded on the phone, a pleasant young man, with a knowing smile in his eyes. Considering the predicament he was in, he did not seem particularly concerned, although Chatham could see signs of tension and nervousness in his body. Strangely, Chatham found that he was not disappointed. "Yes," said the chief constable, in an attempt to take control of the situation. "I believe you're acquainted with Mr. Chatham." "We have spoken on the phone," said Simon, giving Chatham a nod of acknowledgement. "Quite," said the chief constable, who seemed to think that, for someone in his position, Simon was altogether too relaxed. Maybe some introductions would instill a more fitting sense of propriety. "My name," he began, but to everyone's astonishment, Simon cut him off. "I think introductions should wait until Mr. Brennus can join us," said Simon. Chatham almost choked at Simon's front. Did he have no idea how serious his situation was? The chief constable reddened, and the chancellor muttered something under his breath, while Admiral Grant's eyes fixed on Simon like two unforgiving stones. As far as first impressions go, Simon was not doing very well at all, but he did not appear to be intimidated. He faced them all down. "I will answer none of your questions," he said, looking at each of them in turn, "not a single one, until Mr. Brennus is sitting here beside me." The chief constable practically steamed in his chair, but he seemed to realize that this intransigent young man was telling the truth. Drawing his fingers firmly across his broad brow, he nodded to the special branch henchman in the corner of the room. The man left the room, and what descended was about as awkward a silence as it was possible to get. A minute or so passed, and Simon turned to Vice Admiral Fallon as the door opened, and Steve was escorted into the room. Another chair was found, and Steve was invited to take a seat next to Simon. "Vice Admiral," said Simon suddenly, as Steve sat down beside him, "I wonder if I might ask you a question." The Vice Admiral glanced at the men sitting beside him before giving Simon a curt nod. "Imagine, if you will," said Simon, "that someone was going to kidnap you and hold you against your will." The Vice Admiral's eyes focused sharply on Simon as he spoke. "They will hold you captive and never let you go. To your friends and family, to everything you hold dear in life, you will be as good as dead." The Vice Admiral's eyes narrowed threateningly. "Tell me," said Simon, "what would you do to prevent this from happening?"
"Anything," said the Vice Admiral.
"Anything?" asked Simon.
Whatever it took, I would not let it happen.
Simon slid a sideways glance in Steve's direction. Thank you, he said.
All right, said the chief constable, in an angry, sarcastic tone. Now that we're all together.
Simon gave an acquiescent nod. My name is Chief Constable David McCormack, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, I'm sure you recognize, and this is Richard Chatham from MI5. He turned to the two naval officers. This is Admiral Grant of Her Majesty's Royal Navy, and Vice Admiral Fallon, Commander of the U.S. Fleet Forces Command, and former Chief of U.S. Naval Intelligence. He speaks on behalf of the American government. Steve looked at Vice Admiral Fallon. Fleet Forces Command was the name given to that part of the U.S. Navy responsible for operations in and around the Atlantic Ocean. It was one of the most powerful military bodies in the world. And now, if you please, we will be asking the questions. Simon met the chief constable's hard, unpleasant gaze, but in his mind he heard his mother's voice. They will fear you, she had said. I will help them understand. They will try to control you, she had warned. Yes, Simon had said, they will try. Do what you have to do, she'd told him, and he would. Chapter 22 HMS Vigilant, S-30 North Atlantic Ocean. Commander Douglas Scott was embarrassed, angry, and deeply concerned. It was over an hour now since the monitors had shown an unprecedented spike in the reactor's primary cooling system, and the chief of the watch had been forced to activate the emergency blow, bringing the submarine to the surface with explosive force. Over an hour, and the engineers still had no idea as to what caused the problem. And now it appeared that there was also a problem with the submarine's ballast system. The inlet valves were letting in water, and the compressed air cylinders used to purge the tanks appeared to have seized. The sub was slowly sinking.
Was it the emergency blow? Asked Commander Scott, clearly exasperated by the progress.
I wouldn't have thought so, replied the chief engineer. But surfacing like that puts a good deal of strain on the systems.
Commander Scott rolled his eyes and put a hand to his forehead.
And the reactor? Seems okay now, but that heat spike was like nothing I've ever seen.
The chief engineer sounded distinctly defensive.
There's no way we could ignore it, Captain, he said.
No, Jeff, of course not. The captain's tone was mollifying. Everyone has acted just as they should.
It's just so damned embarrassing. We're barely a day into this exercise. The Yanks'll think we're a bunch of incompetents.
Commander Scott straightened up and cast his eye over the attack center. The anxiety in the air was palpable, and everyone looked at the captain to see what they should do next.
Suggestions, he said,
turning back to the senior members of his engineering crew.
We can replace the valves on the air cylinders, put divers in the water to examine the inlet valves.
And the cooling problem?
We've run the diagnostics, said the chief engineer.
And?
Inconclusive. We'd need to wait for it to happen again, see if we could lock it down then.
Great, said Commander Scott, sarcastically. Wait for the reactor to hit meltdown and we can identify the problem. The sense of failure in his crewman's eyes was not an easy thing to behold, and the thought of losing the sub to a mere technical problem was almost impossible to comprehend.
Can we make port?
Not if we keep taking on water at this rate.
How long do we have?
An hour? Maybe two.
Commander Scott pushed his hands through his hair.
Send out a team, he said. Tell them to weld the inlet valves shut. Seal them up with anything they can get their hands on.
He felt like he was taking part in some scrapyard challenge for a low-budget television channel, not commanding one of the most sophisticated ocean-going vehicles in the world.
And comms, he said,
turning to the communications officer.
Contact Force Command.
Tell them we have a disarm emergency and request contingency plans for evacuation of the entire crew.
Aye, sir, said the young communications officer, trying to work some moisture into his dry mouth. Commander Scott listened while the unthinkable message was relayed. Then he watched as the young man at comms queried something that Force Command had told him.
What is it?
The young officer turned towards him and slid the earphones back from his head.
A message received and understood, sir, he said.
And? Asked Commander Scott.
It's not just us, sir, the officer said. It seems there's another sub experiencing similar problems.
Good God, said the commander.
Which one? The USS Carolina, sir. It's one of the Americans' Virginia-class attack subs.
The Carolina, thought Commander Scott. That's Philip Kern's boat.
Chapter 23. The mood in the secure interview room was charged with disbelief.
And you expect us to believe that, said Chief Constable, with contempt.
You have no choice, said Simon. It's the truth.
Psychic, thought Chatham, incredulously.
Nonsense.
And yet, he mused, it would certainly explain a great many things. And, strangely, if it were true, it would make him feel a good deal happier about the security of MI5. Then again, he reflected, his thoughts racing ahead. If it were true, then nothing would be safe, not a secret, not a password, not a personal private thought.
Christ, he thought, that would be terrifying.
Yes, Mr. Chatham, said Simon, fixing Chatham with his stone-grey eyes. It would be terrifying. Chatham's blood turned to ice. And frightened people do frightening things, Simon added. The rest of the Inquisition looked at Chatham, who had turned markedly pale. Simon's gaze moved down the line from one scornful face to the next.
Dangerous?
Vice Admiral Fallon, said Simon. Not unless you give me cause. The Vice Admiral raised a menacing eyebrow. Simon continued down the line. No, Chancellor, you could not use it to your advantage.
Bullshit is not what I call an intelligent response, Admiral Grant.
And, Chief Constable McCormack, if you think this is a waste of time, then I wonder you're bothering to hold me at all. The room echoed with a stunned silence.
Take that, you tossers, thought Steve,
with just a hint of a smile on his stern face. Simon allowed the impact of his impossible insight to sink in. He saw the fear and insecurity in their eyes, the crumbling of their conviction that this could not be true. These men were not accustomed to the sensation of vulnerability. It was not a feeling they found comfortable, although some dealt with it better than others. Mr. Chatham, for instance, seemed as much fascinated as he did threatened. As for the others, shock and surprise quickly gave way to fear and paranoia. Simon knew what was coming next.
Are you trying to intimidate us, young man? Said Admiral Grant, suddenly.
His voice, like his face, had a gravelly quality to it. Simon held the Admiral's implacable gaze.
Do you think you can impress us with Victorian parlor tricks? A quick display of pocketbook psychology.
Simon said nothing. Despite having known what to expect, he looked disappointed.
Just who the hell do you think you're talking to? The Admiral ground on.
With the exception of Chatham, those seated on that side of the table seemed to sit up straighter as the Admiral took the helm.
You seem to have no comprehension whatsoever of your situation.
You're in a great deal of trouble, added Chief Constable McCormack. The best thing you can do is tell us exactly how you breached MI5 security, why you did it, and the names of anyone else involved.
Simon looked from one to the next. They wanted answers, something they could understand. He could not give them that.
You have to understand the implications of what you did, said the Chancellor, in a more conciliatory tone. The figures you gave me were accurate to the last detail. No one makes forecasts with that level of certainty. Forecasts work on trends, patterns, complex mathematical algorithms, but never with such precision. The Chancellor's face effectively portrayed the dismay that he was feeling inside, and Simon almost felt sorry for him. Do you have any idea of the consequences of predictions like that? His wide eyes appealed to Simon. It would be disastrous, he stated. Trust and cooperation between nations would collapse. The normal flow of international trade would be devastated. He threw up his arms as he voiced the fears that struck him like a thunderbolt over breakfast this morning. Now his eyes beseeched Simon. I'm not talking about a blip on the stock exchange, he said, with quiet forcefulness. World recession, depression, that would be the least of it. I know, said Simon, so quietly that only Steve heard him. Wars have been started over much, much less, the Chancellor concluded, as if he could not believe how irresponsible Simon was being. I know, said Simon. He spoke louder now, and to Steve's surprise, there was something like contrition in his voice. That's why you were the first person to know about it. That's why I've asked Mr. Chatham to arrange a multinational symposium to examine the ramifications. All eyes turned to Richard Chatham. Yes, said Chatham, recovering quickly from being put on the spot. 27 specialists from 13 different countries. They have been invited to attend the convention to, his words petered out. Simon came to his aid. I possess abilities that I do not understand. He looked up at the wall of rapt faces. I'm the first person to possess such abilities, he went on. I'm the only person to possess such abilities. But I may not be the last. Simon's grey eyes were as fathomless as the sea. The world needs an opportunity to understand these things, to see what consequences they might have. There was no need to try and speculate on what these consequences might be. The fears raised by the Chancellor had been but the tip of the iceberg. Despite the varying degrees of disbelief, indignation, and outright hostility, emanating from the questioning panel, Simon certainly had their undivided attention. He took a deep breath. That is why I've decided to put myself forward for study, to donate my body to science. As Simon said this, he pointedly refused to look at Steve. The line of questioners was suitably stunned. All I need from you is your assurance that I will not be followed, detained, or in any way constrained until the commencement of the symposium in 4 days' time. Simon looked at the Chancellor of the Exchequer. But first, Chancellor, he said, I need your signature on the immunity for Mr. Brennus. I understand you've been authorized to endorse it in the absence of the Prime Minister. Chatham quickly flipped open his briefcase and slid the immunity documents in front of the Chancellor. He turned to the last page, indicating a blank space that awaited his signature, and laid a pen across the page. Steve turned in his seat to look directly at Simon. He certainly knew nothing about this. The Chancellor stared at the documents before him. This was not the way he had expected this meeting to go. He had expected to encounter a frightened young man, thoroughly intimidated by the weight of power ranged against him. And yet, if what this Simon was telling him was true, then they needed to know more. They needed to know everything. And if granting Mr. Brennus immunity was the way to ensure full cooperation, then it was surely a small price to pay. The Chancellor's hand twitched as he considered signing the form. Then he caught himself. What if this was all a load of nonsense? What if this was a smokescreen for something else? Something more plausible? Something unlawful? Surely that was more likely. Surely genuine psychic ability did not really exist. Simon watched as the Chancellor talked himself back from the brink of the believing. Even after all these years, he could still understand people's doubts. It was just that now he could no longer afford them. Simon looked down at the pen. The Chancellor had come to his senses. This young man should not be calling the shots. He represented the British government, for God's sake. Admiral Grant was right. This was all just bullshit. The pen rose up from the table, and the Chancellor's burgeoning assertions were scattered to the winds. The pen hung in midair, pointed down and rotating slowly as if it were hanging from an invisible thread. But there was no thread, only incontrovertible proof that Simon was telling the truth. The pen angled itself to suit the Chancellor's hand, poised to write. Almost unconsciously, the Chancellor reached out to take the pen. His fingers closed around it, and he felt the vaguest sensation of having taken it from another's hand. The point hovered over the dotted line. Then the Chancellor made to write.
"That's enough for me," said Vice Admiral suddenly.
He turned to Admiral Grant, who gave him a small nod of concurrence. Then he looked at Chief Constable McCormack, who raised a hand to one of the special branch officers. The henchman gave a stiff nod and immediately left the room. Both the Chancellor and Mr. Chatham looked concerned and surprised at this development. It was clear that some prearranged arrangement had been put into action. The Vice-Admiral glanced at them both before he spoke again. "The detainees are to be transferred to a high-security military facility without delay," he said, by way of explanation. "They will be kept in isolation until we convene a specialist team to question them properly."
"On whose authority?" asked the Chancellor.
"On the authority of the American President," said Vice-Admiral Fallon, "and that of your own Prime Minister." The words echoed in Simon's ears, but he did not really hear them. Once again, he was absented from this place, the light of his mind casting shadows of himself, shadows that were present elsewhere.
"The Prime Minister said nothing of this to me," the Chancellor objected.
"The final decision was given to us," explained Admiral Grant. "If we considered this matter to have defense implications, we were to respond accordingly."
The situation had taken a serious turn for the worse. Steve could keep silent no longer.
"You can't do this," he said. "Simon's no threat to you. He's done nothing wrong."
"You misunderstand, Mr. Brennus," said Vice Admiral Fallon. "This is not about the threat, nor is it a matter of wrongdoing. This is about control."
The Vice Admiral looked at Steve as if he, of all people, should understand this.
"Simon represents a new entity," the Vice Admiral went on. "A new capability, if you will. Governments have been looking for years at the possibility of ESP and its applications, both military and otherwise. But there has not been a single breakthrough anywhere in the world. The conclusion has always been that extrasensory powers did not exist. But now..." Here he looked again at Simon. And somewhere in the background, a mobile phone began to ring. "Now we know they do, and we must make certain that it is we, and not our enemies, who control this new capability."
"Then, will someone answer that damn phone?" he barked.
"But what will happen to Simon?"
asked Chatham, as the American aide rummaged in his attaché case for source of the insistent ringing.
"Simon will be detained and studied," explained the Vice Admiral. "He will be treated well and housed in comfort."
"But he will not be free," persisted Chatham.
Vice Admiral Fallon seemed to have no problem with the scruples of this action.
"We cannot afford to have Simon falling under the influence of other parties who might take an interest in his abilities,"
I can assure you, he said smugly, the Russians or the Chinese would not treat him so well as we intend to.
And what if he refuses to cooperate? Asked Steve.
He has no choice, said Vice Admiral Fallon. In time, he will see that.
And how long will you detain him? Asked the Chancellor, who clearly had considerable doubts of his own.
Oh, we cannot let him go, said the Vice Admiral. The world can never know that he exists.
There was silence in the room as the implications of what he was saying began to sink in.
No one will speak of what happened here today. The threat in Vice Admiral's voice was deadly serious. No one will even acknowledge that Simon ever exists. You will forget you ever...
Vice Admiral Fallon, sir, interrupted the aide, who had answered the phone and was now clutching it anxiously as he approached his commanding officer.
Not now, damn it, snapped the Vice Admiral. The Vice Admiral turned back to look at Simon to see if he showed any sign of understanding that his life, as he knew it, was over. He felt no sympathy for the young man. As far as he was concerned, Simon had brought this upon himself. Did he expect them to ignore someone who could break their codes, read their secrets, and tamper with their technology? Hell no! But if the Vice Admiral was looking for signs of regret and humility in Simon's face, then he was sorely disappointed. Indeed, Simon's eyes burned with an intensity that was decidedly unnerving.
Vice Admiral, said the American aide more urgently.
I told you, said the Vice Admiral, rounding on his subordinate. Not...
I think you should take this call, said Simon in a voice which, for all its softness, was utterly chilling. The Vice Admiral shot a blazing look at Simon.
Who the hell is it?
He demanded, thrusting out his hand to take the phone.
It's Force Command, said the aide,
leaning in to convey his message more quietly. Two of the subs on Operation Tsunami have broken radio silence.
Nonsense, dismissed Fallon in a fierce hiss. Nuclear submarines do not break radio silence.
They do if there's a disub emergency, said Steve, who had overheard the whispered words.
Fallon's eyes fixed on Steve like the barrels of a gun. Disub was the code word used to designate a submarine in distress. Fallon put the phone to his ear. The room hung on his words and watched the storm clouds gather on his brow.
You're joking, said Vice Admiral Fallon in a tone that could not have been more devoid of humor.
When?
What is it? Asked Admiral Grant. He moved closer to his American counterpart, speaking in a hushed tone of concern. Vice Admiral Fallon held up his hand as he concentrated on what the force commander was telling him. Then he leaned in close to speak to Admiral Grant.
Operation Tsunami, he said quietly. Two of the subs are in trouble.
Yours or ours?
One of each, said Simon, and suddenly all eyes were back on him. The HMS Vigilant under Commander Douglas Scott and the USS Carolina under the command of Captain Philip Kern. They looked at him as if he were an alien from another world. They will sink within the hour unless you do as I say, said Simon, his eyes holding the horrified gaze of Vice Admiral Edwin T. Fallon.
This is impossible, breathed Admiral Grant. There's no way on God's earth you can affect something hundreds of miles away.
Tell that to the Prime Minister, interrupted Simon. Tell it to the American President.
What is it that you want? Asked Vice Admiral Fallon, in a tone that suggested he would consider just about anything to prevent $6 billion worth of military hardware from falling to the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean.
As I said, intoned Simon, I want your assurance that I will not be followed, detained, or in any way constrained until such time as I choose to put myself forward for study.
And, Simon added, nodding towards the Chancellor, who was still holding the pen in his hand, I want a signature on that Class A transactional immunity.
And if we refuse to do as you ask? Demanded the Vice Admiral.
in a final gesture of defiance. Simon smiled, but it was someone else who spoke.
"Then we sink your fucking boats," said Steve.
Chapter 24. Lucifer surveyed the interior of the black transit van. Not a trace of the heretic remained. He locked the van and closed up the barn, lowering the steel bar across the heavy doors before securing it with the padlock. Then he turned his back on the unsavory requirements of the delusional world and crossed the yard to the chapel. In the sacristy, he donned his cassock and cotta before entering the chapel itself. The stench of confession assaulted his nostrils. He breathed it in. It was confirmation that his calling was being fulfilled, that the prophets of mendacity were being systematically removed from the world, those who claimed to know the minds of men, those who spoke of ailments, conditions, insanity. They knew nothing. They did not know the rapture of attending the chorus in one's mind, the ecstasy of obedience, and the supreme agony of non-compliance. How could they know, those empty vessels of flesh? Lucifer coiled up the corrugated hose and stowed it against the wall of the chapel, the aspergillum and silver bucket he had washed out earlier. A few small spots of the acid had landed on his arm, just above the gloves, and he had clenched his teeth against the pain, silent, not crying out as the heretics would during the cleansing. Their screams spoke of weakness. His silence spoke of strength. He approached the altar and picked up the fist dagger from where he had left it. The blood had left a crimson slick across the short blade. It shimmered attractively in the light. He would not clean it off. He would leave it to dry like that. Put it away another time. Then he crossed over to the lectern to see where his vocation would lead him next. Lucifer gathered up the massive Bible and stood it on its spine. Then, with a quick prayer for guidance, he let the book fall open. On the page that revealed itself, two lines of text were underlined. "I hate pride and arrogance, evil behavior and perverse speech." Proverbs 8, verse 13. And tucked in the crease of the page, a cutting from a medical journal. "The role of antipsychotics in treating audio hallucinations," a lecture by Professor Christian Thomas, Saturday, March the 12th. Lucifer looked at the cutting. He noted the date and the time and heard the rising clamor for action. But no. The latest heretic's body would be found soon. The medically debauched would be alert and wary. The choir agreed. The clamor subsided. Lucifer would be prudent. He flipped the pages back to a leaflet that lay in Psalms. "His mouth is full of curses and lies and threats. Trouble and evil are under his tongue." Psalms 10, verse 7. He lifted the leaflet. International Psychic Convention. He opened it and scanned through the program of events for the following day. Saturday 6th of March, morning, 10 to 11 a.m., Beyond the Veil with Jonathan Fry, Clairvoyant. 11 till 12 a.m., Sixth Sense and Sensibility with Colleen Edwards, Medium. Afternoon, 1 till 2 p.m., A Winning Mind with Sam Delaney, Sports Psychic. 2:30 to 3:30, Challenge the Psychics, An Open Debate. 4 till 5 p.m., Be Thine Master with Susie Murkoff, Psychic Healer, treating everything from shingles to schizophrenia. Lucifer looked at the name of the psychic healer, Susie Murkoff. The name had been circled in black. People like her should not be given a platform for their deceit. She obviously had no comprehension of what true authority was. Be thine master. Perhaps she should be the one to attend a lecture. Know thy place. Heresy comes in many guises. Lucifer would go. Chapter 25. Simon's flat was filled with the smell of Chinese food.
The mood of the two men stuffing their faces was buoyant, triumphant. It felt like a victory feast.
"We sink your fucking boats," said Simon,
doing his best to mimic Steve's voice, but there was no way he could match the savage certainty of Steve's tone.
"Well, that's what you were going to say, wasn't it?" asked Steve, laughing and scraping together the last of his Kung Po chicken with his chopsticks.
"No," said Simon, failing miserably to keep a straight face. "Actually, I was ready to toe the line."
"Yeah, right," said Steve, spinning a prawn cracker in Simon's direction.
Simon looked across the room at Steve. This was the first time he had seen him smile, really smile, as if he were happy. Despite everything, the relief that they would not be disappeared to some secret military base was intoxicating. It put everything else into perspective.
Well, almost everything, thought Simon.
Steve put his plate to one side and took a swig from the cold bottle of beer. "So just how long have you been planning this whole coming out thing?" he asked.
"A while," said Simon, taking a sip of his own beer. It was a typically understated answer.
And the rest, thought Steve, casting his mind back to Simon's planning wall and thinking how efficiently Simon had humbled those in power, those who had thought to confine him.
"So tell me about this business venture of yours," said Simon, suddenly.
"You mean you don't already know?" teased Steve. "I'd rather hear it from you."
Steve quirked his head. It seemed a lifetime ago since he'd been wrangling with bank managers, negotiating with suppliers, and paying a fortune in research costs to companies across the globe.
"It was all about power generation for the domestic user," said Steve, wistfully. "Self-sufficiency for the home."
Simon noted the use of the past tense.
"Wind turbines on chimney stacks," he said.
"Exactly," said Steve with a smile.
"I thought you could get those from B&Q nowadays."
"Yeah, you can," said Steve, "but we're working on a more integrated approach." He sat forward in his chair, and it was clear that, despite everything, his enthusiasm for the project had not been extinguished.
"Super-efficient turbines, designed in Sweden, solar panels from Germany, and a new generation of photoelectric cells developed here in the UK.
Sounds expensive."
"Not as bad as you might think," said Steve, "thanks to a charming wife who haggles like a Moroccan carpet seller."
Simon smiled at the pride in Steve's voice. "We'd also managed to secure enough orders to bring down the unit costs. We'd designed a system that would pay for itself in 5 to 10 years, not the 15 to 20 that the market was currently offering."
"Impressive," said Simon. "I'll take one."
"Sorry, sir," said Steve regretfully. "There's a small problem with supply on account of the business being completely screwed."
Steve looked down at his hands. Then he clapped them together and grabbed his bottle of beer.
"Well, enough about my woes," he said. "There's just one more day of our agreement to go, and I can't wait to see how you plan to top today."
Again, Simon smiled.
"Nothing quite so dramatic," he said.
He reached down the side of his chair, pulled out a leaflet, and tossed it to Steve. Steve caught it against his thigh. He turned it over. He recognized the title. He had seen it on Simon's planning wall. "International Psychic Convention."
"Oh, you've got to be kidding," said Steve, opening it up and glancing through the articles that trailed the various speakers.
"I used to know a Sam Delaney," he said, reading the article about the sports psychic, who was apparently having great success with one of the Premier League rugby teams. He read down the list of sessions scheduled for the Sunday, smiling at the ridiculous names that the speakers had given them. Then, just as it had been on the planning wall, there was one session circled in red. 2:30 to 3:30. Challenge the psychics. An open debate. It was in between the sports psychic and the psychic healer.
"Should be an easy crowd, at least," said Steve. "How'd you work that one out?"
"Well, they already believe in psychics," he said. "Then again," he added with feigned gravitas, "they say a prophet is never recognized in his time."
Simon failed to respond to Steve's cautionary tone. He seemed pensive and subdued.
I was only joking, said Steve, seeing that Simon looked uncomfortable. Surely you must know how it goes.
Simon lowered his eyes. Things get a little hazy from here, he said quietly. Steve was suddenly concerned. Was this the same man who had faced down the head of Fleet Force Command, who had maneuvered the British and American governments into abiding by his will?
This is the fear you mentioned.
Simon gave an almost imperceptible nod. And you can't see through it? The shake of his head was just as slight.